We don't often have sponsors on this podcast, but this week we do, and it's Patagonia. 3 years ago, Patagonia named Earth as its only shareholder, but moving more profits to environmental causes hasn't made them a perfect company, let alone a sustainable one. Out now is Patagonia's 2025 Work in Progress report, the raw truth about where they're messing up, but also the latest ways they're rethinking business as usual. Read it on eu.patagonia.com.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Hello and welcome to The Europeans, the podcast that dares to squeeze everything from Rosalía's latest album to Europe's regulation of algorithms into one gloriously chaotic show about Europe. I'm Dominic Kramer, speaking to you from Amsterdam, and this is a big moment.
Da, da, da.
A very special someone is back in her Parisian studio. Welcome back to the show, Katie Lee.
I'm back. It's very nice to be here. Yeah, back from my maternity leave. You managed not to destroy the podcast while I was away, Dominic. Congratulations.
Just about, yeah. Really nice to have you back. How have you been? Have you had any sleep at all since we last had you on the show?
Bits and bobs, yeah. I've been enjoying hanging out with my lovely little baby boy. He's very cute. And that is a relief, actually, because, okay, this is going to sound bad, but for the first couple of days, he looked a lot like, you know, Eric Zemmour, the far-right politician?
Yeah.
He really looked like him.
Oh, dear.
And there I was thinking like, oh, no, my baby looks like a tiny fascist. But it's all good. He's put on lots of weight. He doesn't look like him anymore.
Wow, I have to Google what Eric Zemmour looks like.
Arguably, Eric Zemmour just looks like a really old newborn baby, rather than my baby looking like Eric Zemmour.
Ah, okay. Mm. Yeah. Oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
He does look like a baby. Oh my God, he looks like a little bird baby.
Yeah, is that a compliment? I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm glad to be back and to have someone to chat to about European politics each week, because things have been messy while I've been away. Like, I spent most of my maternity leave watching the insanity that is French politics get more and more insane by the day. And yeah, we spent the last few weeks airing our latest mini-series, so you haven't had time to tell us about these nail-biter Dutch elections. Great news, apparently,
well,
if the stuff I've read online is to be believed.
Yeah. So that election was just over 2 weeks ago, and so I won't go into it in detail. But yeah, I do want to clarify that I think it's been reported on a bit weirdly in the international press.
Mm.
I think probably what you've read will make you think that it's like a massive win for a centrist, socially progressive party, D66, led by a charming young gay man, Rob Jetta. And you've probably read about how his party beat the far right.
Mm-hmm.
And his party did become the biggest party, but I just want to point out that the biggest party at this Dutch election got less than 17% of the vote, 1-7.
Mm.
Not exactly a thumping victory. And yeah, if you look at it in a broader context, the far right bloc, depending on which parties you include in that definition, arguably became bigger than they've ever been, whilst votes for the left-wing parties plummeted when you look at that bloc as a whole. So yeah, I'm sorry to be a negative Norbert, and I wish Rob Jetta the best. I definitely don't have a crush on him.
Thank you for clarifying.
But yeah, I feel like the election results are not exactly as they've been portrayed by a lot of the international media, sadly.
Oh, well, thank you for starting this episode off on a downer.
You're welcome.
What else are we talking about this week?
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Paris-based fashion journalist Dana Thomas to talk about a scandal that's been making headlines in France. It centers on some horrific childlike sex dolls that were being sold on the website of the Chinese-founded fast fashion giant Shein. The discovery has sparked a big public outcry, understandably, and the timing couldn't be worse for Shein, coming just as an iconic Paris department store opened a huge area dedicated to the brand, its first permanent physical space in Europe. We'll be talking to Dana about Shein's practices and the growing French backlash against the company later on in the show. But first, of course, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Nice to hear that jingle again.
Yeah, and I will give you first dibs. Shall we start with Bad Week? Who's had a bad week, Katie?
Well, this Bad Week is brought to you in collaboration with our radio partners at Euronet Plus, and I am giving it to Latvian politicians for bringing Latvia pretty close to doing something that no country within the EU has yet done. And that is voting to withdraw the country from the Istanbul Convention. Now, this vote doesn't mean that withdrawing just happens overnight. Right now, it looks like it might not happen, which would be a big relief. But it is still very much possible. It's hanging in the balance. But yeah, this thing, the Istanbul Convention, how much do you know about what it actually is?
Nothing really, apart from the fact that it's about stopping violence against women, I think.
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So it is an international treaty that is aimed at preventing domestic abuse and better protecting women from violence of all kinds. And this treaty finally came into existence about a decade ago, after years and years of campaigning by the Council of Europe, which is this club of 46 countries, including all the EU ones. They basically wanted to create like minimum standards for things that countries should do to prevent domestic violence and violence against women. And this treaty has genuinely helped to do this. Many countries have passed new laws in a bid to bring their legislation more in line with this treaty. Spain, for example, clarified its definition of sexual consent. Several countries have outlawed female genital mutilation for the first time. And even on a local level, you know, lots of local authorities have introduced things like telephone helplines you can call, more shelters for domestic abuse victims, really practical things because of this treaty. Most EU countries have now ratified the Istanbul Convention, which is the step that makes it properly fully kind of go into force. But several EU countries have not done that. They are Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Lithuania, and Slovakia.
And what about Latvia?
So Latvia ratified the treaty last year, and it did that after a new government came into office led by Evika Saliņa. She comes from a centre-right party called Unity. And she pointed out at the time that Latvia has a terrible problem with violence against women. Latvia actually has the highest rate of femicide in Europe relative to the size of its population, according to Medusa, which is a Latvia-based news website. Medusa actually has a great interview, by the way, about what has changed for the better for women in Latvia since this treaty came into force. I'll share that in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, it's quite a surprise that just months after this thing passes into law in Latvia, helping to protect women from violence, the very same parliament that voted it in would vote in favour of unratifying it, unsigning it, walking away, basically.
Yeah, why? Why would that happen? Why would their politicians do this?
Well, somewhat ironically, this vote only passed because a party that is within the government went against the Prime Minister and voted in favour of scrapping the treaty. That party is called the Union of Greens and Farmers. They're one of three parties in the coalition government. And they joined forces with opposition politicians to back out of this treaty that is aimed at protecting women and domestic abuse victims. Why would they do that? Well, if you listen to the kinds of things that populist Latvian politicians have been saying about the Istanbul Convention, you get a quite different impression of what it's actually about. I'll give you a couple of the phrases that have been thrown around by Latvian politicians lately to describe what they think this treaty contains. Just to give you a few: gender ideology, radical feminism, undermining family values. Are you getting a sense of the kind of thing that they're trying to imply here?
Sounds like they're trying to imply it's some woke conspiracy. And I mean, is there anything about what they're referring to as gender ideology? So I guess supporting trans rights or LGBTQ plus rights. Is there anything actually about that in this treaty?
Well, the treaty does use the word gender many times. It talks about women facing violence and domestic abuse because of their gender. And it also says that if you're going to sign this treaty, you need to give protection and help to people suffering from this kind of violence without discrimination. And that includes discrimination against, yes, trans women or queer women. All of that feels like pretty uncontroversial stuff in a treaty mm-hmm. that is, after all, you know, about preventing women from being raped and sexually assaulted and beaten by their partners. But the way that some Latvian politicians have been talking about this supposedly woke treaty, you'd think it said something like, you know, all children must go by they, them pronouns, that kind of thing. I mean, it's just nonsense. Like, the idea that this treaty actually threatens their quote unquote family values in some way, like, there's just no substance to it at all. So it is a classic example of populists misrepresenting something to convince a badly informed public that there is a threat that doesn't exist, while being homophobic and transphobic at the same time, of course.
Classic.
Classic indeed. It should be noted that Latvia is not the first country where conspiracy-minded populists have talked about the Istanbul Convention as being some kind of Trojan horse for radical gender ideology. In Poland, the previous populist government actually started the process of withdrawing from the treaty using the same kind of language, but the current Polish government has reversed that decision. Turkey famously became the first country to actually pull out of the Istanbul Convention in 2021.
Ironic.
Right? Yeah, it was like literally unveiled there in the first place. And again, there was really similar homophobic rhetoric at the time, saying it was a treaty that legitimizes homosexuality, that it's against Turkish family values. And yeah, this kind of rhetoric is still echoing a few years later in populist parties in lots of different European countries, including Latvia. But I was curious about why a party that is actually in the government were the party that tipped the vote in favour of scrapping it. Like, they are the ones who have brought Latvia so close to actually going ahead with this. Feels like a pretty weird move, because this party had previously supported the Istanbul Convention. So, you know, why the U-turn? I felt like I was missing a bit of the political context here. So I asked our friends at Latvijas Radio, which is Latvia's national broadcaster. They're also part of Euronet Plus. I asked them why this party, the Union of Greens and Farmers, why did they jump on this really irresponsible bandwagon? And the reporters there, they told me that the official reason this party turned against the treaty is that there have been some state-funded initiatives over the past couple of years that they don't see as in line with traditional family values. But in reality, they said the most likely explanation is that there are elections next year, and this party's ratings are struggling. So they were hoping that taking a stand on this would maybe generate some buzz and make them stand out, which would be a pretty cynical ploy, you know, taking a treaty that has done a fair amount of good in the world to protect vulnerable people and getting rid of it in a country which, just a reminder, has extremely high rates of femicide just to win more votes.
And is there any polling around this convention in Latvia? Like, do the Latvian public support pulling out of the treaty?
So I've only seen one opinion poll, and I guess it should be taken with a pinch of salt, as always with polls. But only 31% said that they supported pulling out of the treaty. And that opinion poll was carried out in early October when the parliament was gearing up for this vote. However, I would bet quite a lot of money that if you did this poll again today, you would get an even more resounding no. Because in the wake of this pretty scandalous vote on October 31st in the Latvian parliament, a massive protest movement has grown up against this vote. Latvians are really outraged that their parliament would vote to leave this international agreement that is aimed at protecting women. Every post I saw online about this had a bunch of people commenting underneath saying stuff like, "I am ashamed to be Latvian right now." And last week, this protest movement spilled onto the streets in a pretty big way. There'd already been some protests over this, but last week, police estimated that 10,000 people turned out to protest in Riga on Thursday. And that's a pretty big crowd in a country with a total population of less than 2 million. Among those protesters was Evika Selinja, the prime minister. She was absolutely furious about the way this vote went. And she joined the protesters and she told them, "We will not give up. We are going to fight so that violence does not win."
Can she do anything to stop this happening? Like, does the Prime Minister have any power, even if Parliament has voted to scrap it?
So the Prime Minister, no, she can't personally stop this from happening. But as of right now, it looks like the President of Latvia has maybe been able to stop it from happening. at least for now. So the Latvian president is a guy called Edgars Rinkevičs. You might remember he actually became the EU's first openly gay head of state back in 2023. And, you know, as a gay man, he is not someone who would instinctively be happy to let the parliament force Latvia out of a important international treaty, essentially because some populists have weaponized homophobia. Rinkevičs doesn't have the power to reverse a vote of parliament. But what he does have the power to do is to send a law back to the parliament and say, I think you need to have another look at this. And that is exactly what he did last week. Rinkevičs was quite cool-headed in the way that he talked about this whole thing. You know, like he could have said something like, this whole situation is outrageous and it will hurt women and the politicians who voted for this should be ashamed of themselves. What he actually said was, well, I think you should think about how this looks to the rest of the world. This same parliament voted to ratify this treaty mere months ago, the same body of MPs. How does it look to our allies if we go back on massive legal agreements this easily? And also, you know, is it a good look really for Latvia to be the first EU country to withdraw from an international human rights treaty? Do we want that particular title? And what the president ended up suggesting in what I think is quite a good diplomatic move is that parliament kick this can down the road and leave it until after next year's elections so that the new parliament can decide on whether they really want to go ahead with this. So it saves Latvia the embarrassment of having signed a treaty and then backed out of it all within the space of a single parliamentary term. And on Wednesday last week, the parliament rather sheepishly agreed that this is what they're going to do. So listen, I mean, I think it's been a good week for Latvian protesters who I think really helped to put a ton of pressure on the parliament and show that people really care about this. And you cannot use an international treaty that is aimed literally at stopping people from killing women to score stupid political points without someone noticing. The parliament, however, they have had a really, really very bad week. Not the politicians who voted against this, of course, but the ones who did. Like, they took a treaty that is about saving lives and they deliberately misrepresented it just to play politics. And they've had a bad week not only because that is shameful behaviour, but I also think a lot of them will be embarrassed at how this has played out. Like, I don't think they're expecting this much of an uproar. And clearly, the fact that the parliament has now voted to kick the can down the road and shelve this for now, that means that at least some of the politicians who voted for this have realised that the move has backfired. It is not the great vote winner they thought it was going to be. It's worth noting that the one country where this treaty has been scrapped, Turkey, femicides have gone up and up and up in that country since it withdrew from the Istanbul Convention in 2021. Whether there is a direct link between the withdrawal or not, it's up for debate. Some academics argue that you can draw a direct link. Others say that it's more that the general climate has become ever more hostile for women in Turkey. They're expected more and more by social conservatives to just not question their husbands. And if they get beaten or worse, then they deserve it. But the fact that Latvia came pretty close just now to becoming the second country after Turkey to walk away from this, it's certainly nothing to be proud of. And there's still no guarantee that the next parliament will see sense. I mean, I hope they will, given how strong the public reaction has been. But we're going to have to wait till those elections to know what the makeup of the next Latvian parliament will be and how they're likely to vote on scrapping this treaty. Those elections are due in October next year. So watch this space.
Ugh, so depressing. Another example of populists learning tricks from each other across Europe. We need to get better at that with more positive initiatives, which is, I guess, why we made that series, Who Does It Best?
Oh, smooth transition. Plug.
Yes.
Go listen to it. People seem to be loving it so far, which is making me very happy indeed. Who has had a good week, Dominic?
I'm giving good week to European workers.
Oh, all of us? That's nice.
Yes, all of us. Great. Well, potentially, anyway, after a majority of the members of the European Parliament who sit on the committee that looks at employment and social affairs voted in favour of introducing new regulation around the use of algorithmic technologies within the European workspace.
So nice to be back. Like, I don't have anyone else in my life to talk to about stuff like this. Gotta love some EU nerdery. Okay, you're throwing me in at the deep end with this. I literally just got back from maternity leave, Dominic. What did you say? Regulating algorithmic... What was it?
Technologies in the workplace, yes. In the European workspace.
Rolls off the tongue. What is that? And can you give me some examples, please, of like how this algorithmic technology might be used in the workspace?
Yeah, sorry, I've really not chosen the most charismatic of EU regulation to discuss this week. For your first week back, I must apologise. But it is really important that we understand it because these algorithms are already being used in so many workplaces across Europe. Hmm. And I saw that the EU trade union that represents professionals and managers is describing it as a digital wild west out there, this world of algorithmic management. Anyway, examples, that's what you asked for. Examples of how algorithms with or without AI are being used in the management processes in Europe. The most common example of an algorithm being used in work is in determining shift times of workers, so for scheduling. According to recent data from the EU's Joint Research Centre, 24% of EU workers have their working time allocated automatically by an algorithm.
Do you know what? Having worked in a newsroom where my boss literally spent most of every day trying to figure out shifts for like a team that worked around the clock, it didn't seem like a great use of time. Like, I'm not super against this. I mean, we could even start doing it at the Europeans, no?
Back from maternity leave and immediately ready to hand over our management to the robots.
Just an idea.
Welcome back, Katie. I can't imagine that there's a human or a robot who could create an algorithm that would work for our very changeable, unique and frankly, sometimes bizarre workflow at the Europeans. But sure, go for it. Try and make it work.
Yeah, you'd have to tell the robot, like, please can you assume that Katie will be working between the hours of 3 a.m. and 4 a.m. while she's
exactly.
feeding her baby.
Another common example of an algorithm getting involved in the workplace is in the determination of which tasks you should do. So apparently algorithms are used for that decision making for 21% of European workers, which is quite a lot as well. Mm. It'll probably come as no surprise to you that algorithms are used in allocating tasks for people who work in the big tech platforms like Uber drivers or delivery people, for example. But algorithmic management is by no means unique to those tech companies. A report from last year that was made by the International Labour Organization and the European Commission found evidence that algorithmic management was making its way into other traditional industries in order to streamline, simplify, and improve efficiencies. For example, in pharmacies or in postal services.
Hmm, interesting. First the post office, next the Europeans.
Yes.
Watch this space. I am thinking about all of this stuff for the first time, so bear with me. But instinctively, like, it doesn't feel like a terrible thing for algorithms to take like some of the really boring mental load of planning stuff like that and deciding what we do. Is it a terrible thing?
No, not necessarily. And banning the algorithms is not what these members of the European Parliament's Employment and Social Affairs Committee are calling for. They're calling on the European Commission to come up with better regulation for the algorithms in the workplace to ensure a, quote, transparent, fair and safe use of automated monitoring and decision-making systems.
Can you actually just spell it out for me? Like, what are the kind of risks of depending too much on algorithms to do some of this management work? Like, why do we need regulation on this?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I read a really good article on this topic on Euronews that outlined a few potential vulnerabilities for people who work with algorithmic management, which I'll link to in the show notes. In that piece, T. Jark from the European Trade Union Confederation talks about examples of algorithms collecting data that, yeah, I think we can agree they really shouldn't be collecting, like data around workers' mental health or data about behavior of employees, even when they're off the clock. And sometimes algorithms are introduced or changed to include new metrics that measure an employee's performance without the employee even being informed.
Mm.
And if these opaque algorithms are being used to assess employees' performance at work, or, for example, deciding whether or not the worker should get a reward for good work, as is the case in 13% of EU workers, then you very quickly start to understand why this area is being referred to as a digital wild west.
And I guess, like, individual employees can't be expected to keep on top of like all the ways that they are being tracked by these kind of algorithms, right?
No, indeed.
And they might not be that equipped to like, if their boss comes to them and confronts them and says like, well, according to the algorithm, you haven't done this, this, and this. Like, they would probably not be very well equipped to defend themselves against decisions that they think are unfair.
No, absolutely. And as T. Jark points out in that Euronews piece, even trade unions are struggling to keep up and struggling to know how to defend workers. Understanding and challenging algorithmic management systems takes a huge amount of technical expertise and resources that many unions simply don't have right now, let alone individual workers. That's one of the reasons why these members of the European Parliament are calling for tighter regulation. And in their recommendations, they're calling specifically for rules that would ensure that there is always human oversight of the algorithmic management and that final decisions around the big things like the termination or renewal of a contract should be made by humans. Mm-hmm. They're also calling for greater transparency around the algorithms and what data they are collecting on workers. And finally, they want to ban the processing of some data, like data of workers while off duty, real-time geolocation tracking outside working hours, private messages, that kind of thing.
These all sound like good things, good ideas. But like, I mean, we already have a bunch of EU regulation around AI, right? And we also obviously have like workers' protection legislation. Do we need a separate thing on this? Can't we like fold it into some existing law?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it is also a question that some of the experts are saying themselves. So that could be one of the conclusions, that they do fold it into something that exists already. There is the EU's AI Act, although I should point out that not all algorithms are AI powered. Algorithms have actually been used in some workplace management since the 1990s. But yeah, of course, with the AI boom, a new wave of algorithmic management is happening. There's also an act called the Platform Work Directive, another sexy one for you to learn about, Katie, which will soon be implemented across the whole of the EU. That directive already contains regulation around the use of algorithmic management in the workplace, but many stakeholders, including a majority of the members of this European Parliament committee, think that that doesn't go far enough, which is why they're now calling for more regulation.
So what actually happens to this proposal now? Like, where does it go? Does it just disappear into the ether, or is it actually going to become something solid?
Well, it depends whether or not the European Parliament vote to move it forward. They'll be voting on it in December, and if it passes, it will then be passed on to the European Commission, the executive body of the European Union, who will then have 3 months to reply, either with a refusal and reasons for that refusal, or with a plan to take the idea forward. So, yeah, it's still not certain that we'll get better protection from these algorithms, but yeah, it's a good step in that direction. So that's why I'm giving good week to the workers of Europe, who might just get some better protection from the algorithm if everything goes to plan. On the other hand, I watched a seminar online from FES Future of Work, and the moderator joked about the fact that most of us have at one point or another had a manager who we wished could be replaced by a robot, which is a good point.
One of the things I found really moving, actually, while I was away, was listening to the podcast each week and hearing you guys read out all the names of all of these incredibly generous people who have decided to support the Europeans with money, actual money. It is now 8 years since we started making this podcast, and we are somehow, implausibly, still here. And I am super aware that we are here by the grace of our listeners. It could all end, you know, not overnight, but certainly next year, if the people who enjoy the show and can afford to support it don't actually reach into their pockets and do that. So a huge thank you to everyone who does support us. You are bringing us that little bit closer to being able to guarantee that we can keep making the Europeans beyond next year. And we haven't done thank yous for a few weeks, Dominic, so I think we have a jumbo list of new supporters to thank.
Yeah.
Do you want to use those singer's lungs of yours to reel off all of these names?
Yeah, let's see if I can do it all in one breath. Okay.
Ooh.
Thank you to Philip, Thomas, Kaloyan, Tony, L, Blake, Maria, Natalie, Aidan, John, and another John, and a Jonathan, Patricia, Tula, Emma, Floor, Anne, Simon, and another Simon. And also thank you to Lisa, Matthew, Marybelle, Michael, Sonia, Hendrik, Claire, and Issei for increasing.
Good week for Johns and Simons. Yeah. They're generous people.
Thank you all so much.
I should have called my baby Simon. I often feel like I have a slightly better week if I do a small thing that feels a little bit good for the world. And you know what? Keeping independent journalism alive in a world where there is less and less independent journalism, let alone fun independent journalism, that is definitely a thing you can do that feels a little bit good for the world. And it's super easy. Just click on the link in the show notes, patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You can give as little as €3 a month and we would be incredibly grateful.
I feel like it's a bit rich describing this as fun independent journalist when I've just rambled on about algorithmic regulation for 5 minutes.
Didn't feel like 5 minutes though. Felt like an hour.
Thanks, Katie. Great to have you back.
When you think of France, one of the things that probably springs to mind is like...
croissants.
Chic fashion. Oh, okay. Well, croissants too.
Sorry.
But also chic fashion,
yeah,
right?
Of course.
I mean, just look at me.
So chic.
Stylishness, maybe like very fancy haute couture fashion houses like Chanel and Dior. But let's be honest, French people are just as addicted to fast fashion as they are everywhere in Europe, which is why there's a quite big hoo-ha here in France at the moment over a threat by the government to ban Shein. If you're not familiar with it, Shein is a clothing company originally founded in China. It's now based in Singapore. And on its website, you can buy the latest fashions at pretty jaw-droppingly cheap prices. It's kind of become infamous for being symbolic of a lot of the bad things connected with the fast fashion industry. Allegations of bad working conditions in its factories, allegations that they have stolen ideas from other independent designers, and of course, claims that the stuff that we buy from them are a major contributor to the rising piles of low-quality, very unbiodegradable clothing that we are sending to landfill every year. None of that is really why Shein is facing possibly being banned in France, though. Last week, it emerged that it was possible, as a French consumer, to buy incredibly creepy sex dolls on Shein's website that seemed to be deliberately designed to look like children. They were, by the way, explicitly marketed as sex dolls, and I won't go into details, but the way that they were presented, it was pretty clear that they were aimed at pedophile customers. The whole thing was just horrible.
Right.
Weapons were also found for sale, apparently, on the site in France. And the court hearing over this, Shein versus the French government, is going to be on November 26th. If Shein wants to continue being accessible on the French internet, the company is going to have to prove that all of the products that you can buy on the site are legal under French law. All of this is terrible timing for Shein because it comes right as France became this month the first country in Europe where Shein has opened a permanent physical store. It has done some pop-ups from time to time. But yeah, this first permanent, supposedly, store is in BHV in Paris, which is one of the city's best-loved department stores. So there's been loads of controversy around that. They're also supposed to be opening stores in 5 other French cities before the end of the year, which is very awkward. The court case is only targeting Shein, the website, not the new physical stores. So we could end up in a weird situation where, like, it's possible to buy a T-shirt from Shein in a shop in Dijon, but not on the internet. We're going to have to see what happens in court. All of this, though, has put a big spotlight on the way that Shein and other companies selling extremely cheap Chinese-made products have become massive players in France and elsewhere in Europe. So the idea that France might become the first European country to ban Shein, at least online, it's kind of an intriguing one. We haven't talked about fashion for ages, so it felt like a very good week for it. So we rang up my fellow Parisian journalist, Dana Thomas. Dana is a veteran fashion reporter. She used to be the contributing European sustainability editor for British Vogue, and she is the author of Fashionopolis, a really deeply reported book about the fast fashion industry. The perfect person to talk to, in other words. We gave her a ring on the other side of town. Mm-hmm. Dana, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. I'm glad to see you all and talk to you.
Likewise. So I've actually got the Shein website open on a different tab, and I can see a top for sale for €2.48. I can see a dress for €8.92. I mean, how is Shein able to produce clothing this cheap?
Well, the reason it's able to produce it so cheap is several points. The first is super, super, super cheap labor. If something costs €2, that means the person who's making it is being paid 2 cents. So it's super cheap labor, and they may be paid nothing because a lot of this now is being done by robots. The second thing is, of course, they're using the cheapest materials out there, and that would be polyester, nylon, petroleum-based materials that never biodegrade because they're basically plastic. And as the price of petroleum keeps dropping, and we have a surplus of it right now, polyester is getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And then, of course, the third biggest reason is because their business model is based on volume. And it's cheaper to produce 100 than it is to produce 80, but put a few more zeros on the end of that, like many more zeros. So the more volume they move, the cheaper they can sell it for, because they can just keep jamming out the same thing over and over and over again. And then the fourth main reason is because they have no bricks and mortar. They have hardly any overhead besides the materials and the robots and some labor. I mean, their marketing campaigns are on social media. They're not buying pages in Vogue, right? Or they're not putting on commercials on television, the things that normally cost a lot of money in advertising. They're doing super cheap advertising, and they have no overhead in the retail space. It's all direct to consumer. It's all online. It's really easy. And they can flip, lastly, on a dime really fast. If something's not working, they stop it like that, and they try something else that works. It goes really fast. And then if it takes off, like, you know, goes viral, then they can just keep making it until people get tired of it. So there's a lot of different reasons, but put that all together and you get the €2 shirt.
Mm-hmm. And what impact does that have on the planet?
Well, I mean, it's a disaster on so many different levels. First of all, like I said, petroleum-based materials like polyester, nylon, neoprene, spandex, it never biodegrades. I mean, scientists say, oh, it'll biodegrade in 1,000 years, but are you going to be around in 1,000 years to see if it actually biodegraded? I don't think so. And then we only recycle 1%, if even, of all our clothes. So most of these clothes wind up in the dump, in landfill, where they're never going to biodegrade. And when they do sort of like start moldering in the earth, they start leaching all these toxic chemicals and nastiness because they're petroleum-based. And then they're also using toxic dyes that are really bad for the planet and bad for us. I mean, just let's talk about denim for a second. You know, cheap denim is dyed with synthetic indigo. And synthetic indigo has things in it like formaldehyde and cyanide and aniline, which, you know, has been proven to cause cancer. So, and you want to put that against your skin, which is our largest organ and it's most porous? Yeah, no. Why would you ever do that? You know those spy movies where the guy like has a cyanide pill in his ring, mm-hmm. and you could just eat your jeans. So, of course, when that goes in a landfill, all that stuff leaches into our water tables too, and then it affects, you know, nature, it affects plants, it affects our water systems, it affects us, it all leaches into us. And then lastly, the most important thing that's really terrible about these clothes, besides them never biodegrading and they being toxic to the water table and we're overproducing them and we have way too many, is that they release microfibers when washed. Plastic microfibers. And I thought that this was kind of a bad thing, but I didn't realize how bad it was till I started really researching it. Did you know that approximately 1 million microfibers are released in every load of laundry we do?
Oh, God. No, I didn't know that.
So that gets all flushed into our water systems. That gets washed into our seas, into our reservoirs, into everything, into our rivers, everywhere. Microfiber's been found in Antarctica. Microfiber's been found in the rain in the Rockies. Microfibers have been found floating in the air in London. So it's not just bad for the planet, it's bad for us.
This is why my husband makes me wash all our polyester things in a special anti-microfiber bag.
A special bag. Yeah. It's not the perfect solution, but it helps. I mean, the perfect solution is just to not buy polyester. But of course we are, because it's only €2 a piece. Mm-hmm. And so the amount of clothes that we're burning through right now is just mind-boggling. We buy 5 times more clothes than we did a generation ago. We pay 1/5 the price than we did a generation ago. If we stopped making clothes today, we'd have enough new clothes already existing on the planet to be dressed fine until 2050.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clear that Shein has a lot of questions to answer about its sustainability and what it's doing to the planet. It also has quite a lot of questions to answer about some things that have been appearing on its website. And I mean, how is it possible that something as gross as childlike sex dolls could end up for sale on this website? And also apparently weapons.
I know. That's what happens when there's no oversight. And that's what happens in a globalized society. All the things that I just mentioned weren't happening 50 years ago. We weren't overproducing the way we are today. We weren't using all these toxic materials like we are today. We weren't, as the norm, paying people half a living wage, not offering them things, basic things that we take for granted, such as vacation time, overtime. Like, oh, I worked 14 hours today, but I'm only still getting paid what I would get paid if I stayed 8. 50 years ago, that wasn't going on because we produced in countries that had oversight and unions that made sure that those laws were enforced. But all of it moved offshore during the age of globalization after the passage of NAFTA and other, you know, similar laws. In our globalized society, things move to countries where there is zero oversight. And, you know, it's the wild, wild west. There is no regulation. And so that's what you get.
I mean, even before the news about the sex dolls, there was already a pretty big backlash here in France over plans to open this first permanent physical store for Shein in Europe. And, you know, at the same time, more than 50,000 people have been to that shop in just the first few days. Like,
yeah.
It's hard to figure out what people actually want. Like, what do you think the response to this store opening says about how consumers actually feel about fast fashion?
Well, the store opening for me is one of the wiliest moves I've seen in a long time because, you know, they weren't in the bricks and mortar business. And then the French passed a law saying, if you only are an online fast fashion retailer and you don't have stores in Europe, we're going to pass this legislation to rein you in. That was clearly because they were trying to pass an anti-fast fashion law. And Zara and H&M and Mango and Gap have very powerful lobbies and, you know, basically said, listen, a lot of us are European companies. You can't do this to your European companies that we have stores all over your, you know, you want us to close our stores all over France? We will close our stores all over France. So, okay, they're like, okay, if you have stores, you can keep doing what you're doing. But if you're only doing direct consumer, basically Temu and Shein, then we're going to come down on you. So what did Shein do? They opened a store. I mean, that was probably the fastest meeting they ever had. Oh, how do we get around this law? Let's just open a store. And what's more, they didn't just open a store. They opened it across the street from City Hall. La, 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 la. And then they're opening them all over the country. So now the French aren't going to come down on them because they're opening them up in these small, in not small towns, but sort of secondary cities where the city centers have been gutted by suburban sprawl. And they're opening in these department stores in the city centers. So this is going to bring commerce and business into these dead city centers, so they can't really complain. You know, but what do consumers want? This is the problem, and this is actually why I wrote my book Fashionopolis, because a lot of people don't know what the impact of not just these fashion brands, but all of globalization has had on planet and humanity. I tell the story of this impact through the lens of fashion because it's much easier to explain, you know, the impact of a t-shirt and a pair of jeans than it is to talk about widgets. And it's, you know, it's sexier, it's easier, people understand it. I mean, we make 6 billion pairs of blue jeans every year, and at any given moment of the day, half the planet's wearing blue jeans. So if I can talk about how your blue jeans are impacting the planet and humanity, then maybe the rest will come into view too. So we're over-consuming, and we've been conditioned to think it's absolutely perfectly fine to be buying so many clothes and to be paying so little for them. And so then we say we can't afford it. But in fact, we can, and we did for a really long time. We spent 15 or 16 or up to 20% of our annual income on clothing a generation ago. And we were buying 1/5 the amount of clothes that we do today. Now that is in the low single digits, that piece of the pie. But we're buying 5 times more. I believe that most of the people who are shopping at Shein and Temu have no idea. And I should just probably go out and stand in front of the Bay Ashvay and hand out copies of my book.
Now that's a sales strategy. I think the upshot of all of this is that we all need to be a lot more like you, Dominic. Can I just say, you are the person in my life who is, I think, the best at digging out
like really cool secondhand clothes on Vinted and places like that.
Thank you. That's the nicest compliment you've given me forever. You can stay.
Thank you. It is really time consuming though, doing what you do.
It is really time consuming. And I sometimes just feel a bit like envious of all these people I see in the street wearing pristine new looking clothes.
That they got from Shein.
Yeah. Or just from Primark or H&M. I sometimes think, God, I'm spending so much more money. I look so much more scruffy, but I look more unique, huh?
I've actually got a different strategy for staying sustainable. Like, I was looking at some photos the other day from like 7 years ago, and I'm still wearing exactly the same clothes. So I've got my own tip, which is like, get yourself some small children or a pet or a really busy job, like anything that keeps you too busy to invest any time in your appearance. Just like, be a slob. It's sustainable.
I love that. It's the opposite of what most Dutch people do, because I read a really depressing statistic that the average garment bought in the Netherlands is only worn 7 times.
Oh, that's so grim.
It's really grim. Anyway, if you want to hear more from Dana Thomas, I really recommend you check out her award-winning podcast, The Green Dream.
Yeah, she also has a very popular newsletter about fashion called The Style Files. It's on Substack. You'll find a link to it in the show notes. And her book, Fashionopolis, which you mentioned, it came out a few years ago, but it still feels extremely relevant if you want to better understand how the fast fashion industry actually works. Let us chug into the inspiration station. What have you been enjoying this week, Dominic?
Well, I've been enjoying a lot. It's an amazing time of year for culture in general. So many new TV shows and films and books and podcasts coming out as the days get shorter and colder. I've been listening to a lot of new music, actually, and I couldn't help but pick Rosalía's new album, Lux, as my choice for Inspiration Station this week. All the European gays are going wild for it, including me. Have you heard it yet, Katie?
I haven't. Is it everything the European gays have dreamt of?
I think it is, yes. I really love it. If you don't know who Rosalía is, you're clearly not gay. She is a 33-year-old Catalan singer and one of Europe's, or one of the entire world's, most genre-bending pop stars. Lux, her latest album, is really not your typical pop album. She made it with the help of many collaborators, including one of my favorite living classical composers, the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Caroline Shaw. And she enlisted a little group called the London Symphony Orchestra to accompany her for this album.
Fancy.
So yeah, it's quite a bombastic project. The album is her 4th album, and it contains songs in 14 languages, from Ukrainian to Sicilian. And of course, she sings in her native Catalan quite a lot as well. I saw someone on Instagram saying that with all these languages, the album is a bit like a European Commission press conference.
If only European press conferences were like Rosalía albums. If only.
You're right. Then we'd be fine. Maybe that's what they should do. Anyway, it's anything but institutional, this album. The first single she released was a song called Berghain, featuring Iceland's own genre-bending pop superstar Björk. And even if you don't want to listen to the album or if you don't have time, I recommend you go and watch that video. It's visually stunning and musically like nothing else I've heard from pop land.
Does it take us inside Berghain, the famously secretive Berlin nightclub?
It definitely does not. No. It's really, yeah, I don't want to describe it. I think you should just watch it.
Okay.
I also saw that it was filmed in Warsaw. And in general, it's the whole project is a very pan-European affair. So perfect thing to discuss on this podcast. Yeah, just go and listen to it. I think she's a total genius, Rosalía.
Ah.
And yeah, I'm a cliche for loving it, I guess.
Can't wait to hear this album.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, I've managed to get through quite a few podcasts over the past few months while feeding my baby in the middle of the night. And one of them is a cross-border true crime series called Where Is Yon? Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't. Where is it made?
So it is a series that's been co-produced by Ireland's national broadcaster RTE and Iceland's national broadcaster RÚV. And yeah, I'm not usually into true crime as a genre, but the series doesn't really feel like, you know, it's like reveling in something terrible happening. It's just a really good piece of journalism. It's about an Icelandic poker player called Jón Jónsson who flew to Dublin for a poker tournament in 2019. And he just disappeared, literally off the street. Wow. Without a trace. It is a total mystery what happened to him. And what I really like about the series is that it's really sensitively reported. Like, they really approach all the pain that this disappearance has caused for this family with a lot of care. And it's also cool to see journalists from two different countries coming together to say, okay, you know, we have contacts in both of the countries involved in this. We speak both of the languages. Let's see if we can better understand what happened here by working together. And they do uncover some new information. So it's a great example of a cross-border collaboration. I thought this series was really well done. You should check it out. It is called Where is Jón? Jón spelled J-O-N. And you can presumably find it wherever you're listening to this.
I'm going to listen to it. I'm suddenly getting back into podcasts. I know it's a stupid thing to say on a podcast.
Oh, but you were finishing a massive audiobook, weren't you?
I was really into audiobooks for a while, it's true. And now I'm like, oh yeah, podcasts are great. And there are quite a lot of miniseries out at the moment.
Ooh.
Yeah, anyway, keep listening to this podcast, everyone. Don't spend all your time listening to true crime podcasts.
Yeah, we've got a miniseries. Listen to our one.
Time to close out the show, as always, with a happy ending. And this week's happy news was sent in by listener Britta in Portugal, thank you, who wrote in to tell me about the opening of Europe's first major sanctuary for captive elephants.
Aww.
Do you remember that I actually talked about an elephant retirement home on the podcast already many years ago?
Oh yeah, rings a bell. What happened to that?
That was a smaller one in France. It had space for just a few elephants. This one in Portugal is going to have space for 20 to 30 elephants.
Nice.
It's a huge operation. And the reason why it's good news is because it's really necessary. Elephants that have been retired from circus performances, maybe because the practice has been outlawed in a specific country, or elephants in zoos that might be closing their elephant departments, don't have anywhere at all to go.
Elephant department. I hope they're not subject to too much algorithmic management.
Well, or maybe I hope that they are.
Sorry, I got distracted. Back to the story.
Anyway, this means, for example, that governments often are unable to enforce animal welfare rules around elephants when they are being flouted because there wouldn't be anywhere to move the elephant to. That will soon no longer be the case, with this sanctuary expecting to accept its first residents in January next year. Apparently, Portugal has the best climate possible within Europe for the elephants, and they're going to have hundreds of hectares to roam freely.
That's so nice.
It is really nice. And I mean, you might think, oh, I want to go and visit them. But something I think that's especially nice about it is that you won't be able to go and visit them. They're not there for your entertainment. Mm. They're there for them. It will only be open to the public for a few days each year. And that will actually only be for local residents. But I think it will lead to happy elephants. So I'm very pleased for them.
Me too.
That's all we've got time for. Thank you, Katie, for being here again.
Yeah.
For your first episode since maternity leave. Will you do it again?
I think I will. We'll be back next week. It's nice to be able to say that. In the meantime, social media, that's a thing, right? We didn't get cancelled while I was away?
I don't think so, not yet.
Okay, good. You can find us on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Europe's very own Mastodon.
I've actually started enjoying Mastodon whilst you've been away.
Right? It's fun there.
You were right. I was wrong. Sorry.
Everyone, go to Mastodon. It's nice there.
This episode was produced by Morgan Childs. Mixing and mastering was by Wojciech Oleksiak. And there was editorial support from Kat Laszlo. It was a whole team affair this week.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bisous la bas.